Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
It's been a while, mate.
No, it hasn't.
No. It's been a while.
It's been, a lot shorter than the last episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That was a nice break last time. I need another one.
You need already?
Yeah, it's been one of those days.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's just can this recording and so we'll see everyone back in another fortnight's time.
Yeah, all right. And that's it for this. No, it really, really has been one of those days. You know how some days you wake up and the sun's shining and you feel good and you know it's going to be a beautiful day.
I haven't seen one of those for a while. Have you seen the weather out there at the moment?
Yeah, I know. Then other days you wake up and a meth head in a stolen car fleeing the cops bounces off a cop car and smashes into the back of your car outside the front of your house.
Metaphorically speaking?
Yeah, metaphorically speaking, but also that's actually how my day began today.
I don't know where to go from there.
Well, yeah. Anyway, that was my day. So that was a bit of drama this morning.
And fun and games.
The ongoing drama that comes with sorting all that out.
When everyone in the family's fine? No one got hurt?
Everyone's fine. No one got hurt. Yeah, it could have been a lot worse.
Yep.
Could have been a lot worse.
Good to hear.
Yeah. It was all a big adventure until Riley found out that they wouldn't be bringing the car back. It's right off.
Oh.
And then she was devastated. She was sad. She wants the car back. She wants the car to come back.
That's the last thing you need, isn't it? To one, be without a car. Two, now you got to go sort that shit out with it, and you weren't planning on it.
That's right. Fortunately, we have another car. Unfortunately, that one was parked in front of mine, and there's no visible damage, but it was literally shunted forward about 2 meters. And I checked the handbrake, and it seems fine. But like you know, there's no visible damage, but it's what you can't see that worries you. So I've got someone coming out to take a look at it. But until then, you know, we don't trust driving it. Don't trust the car seats in either car now. Well, yep. the two in my car are fucked, like covered in glass. The whole back window, like completely shattered in. Plus, like one of the seats is all crumpled anyway. A bit like helmets, right? Like once they've had an impact.
I was just going to say that, just like a bike helmet. Yep. Any accident, like you just throw them in the bin and start again. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Actually, don't just throw them in the bin. You destroy them before you put them in the bin. Save someone else from
trying to you got to cut the webbing off. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then fortunately, after that, it's been a mellow, uneventful day. Apart from this big security clusterfuck that hit the news.
Now, I didn't hear about anything because I guess my head's just firmly buried in the sand.
Yeah.
But what, in your terms, security clusterfuck are you talking about?
Well, let me set the scene. Do you remember last year we did an episode called It's Time to Let JavaScript Go?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was wrong.
Hang on. Can we get that on recording?
It is on recording.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure I don't know if I've heard that one coming out of your mouth before.
Really?
Don't think so.
I like
say it again. Just for the record, say it again.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I like to think I'm usually the first to put my hand up and say when I'm wrong. If that's not true, then I need a fucking talking to.
We'll take that one offline and I'll go through all the transcripts and see what we'll come up with.
Okay. So I was wrong, and that's kind of only partially related. And I've been meaning to circle back to that because I wasn't wrong about everything. And I would even say I was correct in my analysis and I was correct in my diagnosis, but I was wrong in my prognosis.
So just to rehash and, you know, as much as I want everyone to go back and listen to that previous episode, remind me again, that was yet another supply chain attack in the world of JavaScript and NPM?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, the yet another supply chain attack is we're just completely immune to it now. Like we're just, what's the word? Not inoculated, desensitized.
No, I was going to say, it's not that we're immune to it. It's that we're desensitized to it.
We're completely desensitized to it because it just happens all the time now. The problem with that is that we're not taking it seriously anymore. Anyway, that's another thing. So it's a worm called Shai-Hulud, and it had popped up and it was infecting tens of thousands, if not millions of repositories, and so on and so forth. My article that I wrote and our blog post where we spoke about it was about how this is a bigger problem. And the problem wasn't about not doing governance right. It's about this ecosystem being ungovernable. And that is still true. And it's a bigger problem than we spoke about. And that's what we'll talk about tonight a bit.
Yep.
But what I said was that the culture and the language and the ecosystem are inseparable. And that's why I concluded that there's basically no way out. We've just got to let JavaScript die. And that is the part I've changed my opinion on. And I'm not saying that there is a way out, but I am saying that there is something that I didn't see, and that's potential. And that's something worth fighting for, I guess. And we can talk about that. But the thing that is interesting to me about what has happened today that ties back to this is there was a part here where I spoke about how Shai Hulud had made the jump from NPM to Maven.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the phrase that I used was zoonotic spillover.
Yes, that's right.
And yep. I'm still quietly proud of that one. But anyway, that's what has happened again. That literally happened within the past 24 hours, and it has made the jump from Shai Hulud, the same worm, has made the jump from NPM to Go.
So it's, okay, made it from one language to another now.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was that term again?
Zoonotic spillover. Zoonotic spillover. That is the term used in biology when a pathogen or infection makes a jump from one species to another. So when bird flu infects humans, that's called zoonotic spillover.
Yeah. And I mean, it certainly sounds exactly like what's happening here, where it's gone from JavaScript NPM to Maven and now into Go.
Exactly. And what's interesting here is that, I mean, I think it's not just an analogy anymore. It's now a pattern.
Yeah.
Because it's happened more than once. And the other thing is, and I did talk about how this could, because I mean, I do think there is a problem in NPM that is unique to NPM. I don't think the other package distribution ecosystems are immune to it, but mm-hmm. I do think they are more robust against it in ways that NPM isn't. But NPM is a threat to those other things as well. And that's what we've seen here. And I spoke about that a bit more in the article as well. We can come back to that. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of terrifying in a way, like where we are. And I think what's really interesting about this is the new vectors that we saw. So I don't know if you've seen, did I send you the article? Or there's a few articles and videos. Never. We'll put these in the show notes, right? It's actually really interesting how this has happened, right? And we've seen similar things before, and this is a unique vector. So what they talk about is that the indicators of compromise in this attack are all agentic harnesses. So what happens is, let me just go back to NPM for a moment. So what was happening before in NPM, the specific risk, one of the specific risks in NPM was the lifecycle scripts. So with NuGet, for example, there is a risk of a compromised NuGet package executing arbitrary code, but that gets executed on build. Mm-hmm. So you do at least have the chance to inspect it, right?
Yep.
Before you build or run it. But NPM has install lifecycle scripts, right? So it's got pre-install, install, and post-install.
Mm-hmm.
And that was primarily the vector for all of these NPM infections. Was mm-hmm. that, you know, that the package itself, like the payload, the package is fine, but the scripts that execute as part of the lifecycle pull in other things or do other malicious things. And that's where things get nasty, right? Now, the advice typically has been you can use a flag, a CLI flag with them, which is --ignore-scripts, which yep. stops those things running. And what's also interesting is that in the new version of NPM, that's now the default. So it's taken them God knows how long, but the default is now the safe version.
Yeah.
And you have to manually execute those scripts. Remember my everything is too hard talk that I was telling you about the
yep.
unsafe. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So that's kind of how they worked before. Now, obviously, that's in NPM, right? In Go, which is where this has made its way to now, it's different. And the thing is like the ignore scripts, the advice is basically run the ignore scripts. But that doesn't work anymore, because what these things did is they actually infect the agent files. So your .claude/settings.json or your cursor rules setup or your Gemini settings or even your VS Code tasks file.
Yeah.
So you can, again, like VS Code has tasks that execute automatically, right?
Yeah.
So this can compromise that execution pipeline so that as soon as you open a compromised workflow, boom, it runs it, right?
Oh.
You can disable that, but it's not disabled by default. And if you do disable it, it's not debilitating, but like the reason those tasks execute is I wouldn't say a good reason, but the convenience that it provides is something that a lot of people depend on.
Yeah.
So then you've now got this thing that runs basically on execution lifecycle scripts in your code editor and your agentic harness, right? It also, I just won't run it locally or I won't build locally. Yeah, that doesn't help either because it deliberately targets CI/CD workflows. Like it's specifically got GitHub Actions runners targets. It targets OIDC tokens, although of course OIDC is much better because it's shorter lived, although the short-lived thing is a whole other debate. So yeah, so basically all of the traditional advice here isn't relevant anymore. But what's also really interesting, because this goes on to broader advice and more general, is how it actually worked, right? So I'll be honest, I'm not an expert on this part of the ecosystem. This is just going off what I've understood from what I've read. Basically, the way that these things happen in NPM, and one of the problems with NPM is that like it's not binaries, right? So you can pin things with hashes, and I'll come back to that later. But with NPM, apart from the permissive version ranges and the deep dependency and all that sort of shit, like you are literally pulling down arbitrary code and executing it, right? Not a binary, not a signed binary, not a hashed binary, just arbitrary code, right?
Yeah.
Well, this doesn't do that, right? So with Go, you don't do that. Like with NuGet, you don't do that. But with Go, you have this system called JIP, GYP. And basically, there was a phantom JIP, like this binding.jip that's an install trigger. It bypasses all of the, well, it doesn't really bypass it, but it kind of short undercuts any value in looking at the code and auditing the scripts or you know, any of this. Because what it actually did that was really interesting, and interesting for a reason that we'll go on to, it fetches a binary payload that's not in the package, so can't be detected until runtime, executes via an absolutely legitimate path.
But what's the legitimate use case?
Of what?
Of that whole mechanism.
It's the same as NuGet. It's a binary, right? So this is something I said in my article, right? So if you wanted to infect the NuGet ecosystem with an NPM worm, you could.
Yeah.
And the way that you could do that is that, yes, NuGet packages do not have install scripts, but they can have MS build targets.
Yeah.
And even if they don't, they can instruct you to have MS build targets or run NPM. How many Razor class libraries have you seen that include Tailwind and have a Tailwind build script built in or tell you to run it? And this is the thing, is this runs on build. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to run when you do .NET restore, but as soon as you do .NET build, you could be theoretically running something that pulls in, that you know, node executes and pulls in an NPM script and runs it. But that doesn't even matter for reasons that I'll get onto. The point is, like, there are reasons to build and run binaries, right, when you're doing software development.
Yeah, but not at install time, I guess, is where I'm still stuck at. Not when I'm dragging down dependencies. A build, yes, but not when I'm doing a restore.
Well, it's not as uncommon as you think, right? So if you look at pods, so this is used to be Cocoa Pods, which was the Mac OS development thing, and now you can do it with Swift Pods. And now there's SPM, which is Swift Package Manager. This actually has the same thing, like a Swift package reference, even without in either a pods file or even in SPM makes it a bit better. But like you can literally have a script in there that says, and this can be like a distributable package file, right? Where you say, and SPM does the same thing. Like literally it points to a repo and it has effectively a pod file or a package file. And that package is basically a script. And it says, you know, so with macOS and iOS and Swift and well, with Objective-C, you have these XC frameworks, which are the binary equivalent of NuGet, right? So it's your binary. It's actually a zip. It's basically a zip. It's like very, very similar to NuGet, right? Basically a zip. And your package manager is a script that says, download this file. And you can also have things like, you can do things to make it safer, like having a hash that's pinned. So when you download it, you can verify the hash. But that means that you are literally having executable scripts that are part of your package definition. It's a big problem. It's a broad problem. And it's not an unsolvable problem. It's just one that we don't want to because it's too hard. And not because it's too hard. I mean, the way that we do things now makes it not impossible, but impractical. And changing to do things a way that makes it practical makes things harder. And changing our culture is hard. Anyway, in fact, this is the problem, right? This is so ingrained in everything that we do. Like we're sitting here and saying, that doesn't sound right. Surely you wouldn't do that, right? But we do. We do it all the time. Yeah. Let me give you some examples. And you probably see this less in Windows land than you do in, like, you see it everywhere in Linux land, right? But and less so in Mac land and much less so in Windows land, but you still see it, right? And that is the, you go onto the website for some open source package or software,
yep,
and it says, here's how to install it. And it's like, run this script. And usually it gives you some kind of command, which is curl or, you know, like a wget, whatever, to yep, like basically get the file, the script file from their repository or website and then run it.
Mm-hmm.
So like paste this into your terminal and run. So we all do it all the time, right? We run arbitrary scripts off the internet. Yeah. Now, of course, don't forget, like everyone says, oh yeah, but you know, you got to read them. Don't just run things without reading them and checking what they do. There's two problems with that. The first is that the overwhelming majority of people don't, because the overwhelming majority of people can't. They don't know how to. Like, I don't claim to know how to audit every script I could possibly look at. No, I certainly do.
Have you read every single EULA that you've signed in terms and conditions?
Of course not.
Exactly.
Of course not. But that's different, right? I won't even claim to have done that.
But they're written, I mean, but they're, to me, like, it's very similar in that, like, they're there, and sure, best practice is to read every single line, but really, who does?
That's literally exactly the problem. Exactly, right? But there's two layers to it, right? So that's one. The overwhelming majority of people don't, because they can't. But even those that can and do, like, here's the thing, is I never just run a script without looking at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that even when I look at them, unless I, you know, most of the time I don't know what I'm looking at. Like, you know, yes, I could read through it with a fine tooth comb and understand it, but you have to just make a trust judgment call. You have to. It's the only practical approach. You know, like, this is the thing, is like, even when I do read through them and I do say, yes, okay, that's fine, I get it, that seems okay. But the problem is that it's never just a script that you look at and then you're like, oh, okay, that's that script, I've read it, I understand it, that's fine. That's not how it works. Like, these things pull in other things and they have dependencies, and you start going down a chain, and it gets to a point where it's just completely impossible. And this is the thing with the same with NPM, right? The deep dependency chains make it completely impossible. You absolutely cannot practically read through that script, read through every binary and every source repo for every binary that it references, every script it references. Like,
no, you can't.
Like, this example with the binding.jip, right? It's like, you run the script, install the package, you look at the script, you say, oh yeah, okay, that's fine, that's not doing anything malicious, it's just downloading and installing a binary. Like, literally, that's what we do, and that's what we look at, and that's what most of these scripts do. Well, yeah, what's in the fucking binary?
It's like, were you in that chat that's got the meme where it says, you know, I don't trust any code that AI has written, so I read through everything, and yet I've got a, whatever, like an 8 gig NPM install.
Oh, that screenshot of that tweet on X that I shared in that chat that you're talking about.
You shared that. Yeah. It's exactly what you're talking about, right?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
And I guess that just goes to point, right? No, you can't be expected to read every single script and understand every single script and executable in every single thing that you're dependent on, because no one's got that time, right? No one's got that brain power, that capacity. Just, it's impossible.
It is.
But we do have in our toolkit static analysis tools.
There is a problem there, but keep going.
I'm just thinking, can they be used in a way to help us protect those downstream attack vectors?
Mitigate, yes. Protect against, yes. Prevent, no. Should we be using them? Yes. But there's two layers of problem with that, right? Let me just wrap this part up, right? Because I've been thinking about this term that I think we should coin, right? And I think we should call it the read the script fallacy.
RTFM.
RTFS.
RTFS, yeah.
Fucking script, I don't know. But it's bullshit, because for all the reasons we've just described.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll give you some other examples, right? So I've recently been rebuilding my home lab setup. Have you heard of something called Proxmox?
I've heard of, haven't had a chance to play with. I just don't have time or resources to get that to play with that one.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's a hypervisor.
Yeah.
It is a bit of a pain to get set up, actually. But once you do, and once you get your head around it, it's very cool. It's very nice. And it's. I mean, in the past, I've used the Hyper-V and ESXi, and it works differently, and it gives you a lot of things for free. There's a lot about it that's very nice. Anyway, there is a repo called community scripts, which is a whole bunch of things like, here's how you automatically set up. One thing that's interesting about Proxmox is that it runs like full virtual machines. It runs, and then it runs what's called LXC containers.
Yeah.
LXC containers are different to OCI containers. So OCI is like what Docker and Podman use,
uh-huh.
where they're completely isolated and have their own runtime
yeah.
and only have resources that you pass through. So LXC containers are different in that they have self-contained runtimes, but they actually, they have self-contained runtime dependencies, but the execution space is the same as the host.
Mm-hmm.
So there are pros and cons, but like for things like if you want to run resource intensive things, like you can pass a GPU through a lot more easily. So if, you know, so on and so forth, there's use cases.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's one. Well, I guess this isn't a discussion to dig into the technicalities.
But what's interesting is that the community scripts repo has like ready-made one-click deployments for a whole bunch of different Proxmox guest runtimes, you could call them, right? And most of them run in LXC containers. Not all. Some of them run in VMs and what have you. It can't natively run OCI containers. I think actually the new version can. Anyway, we're not going to get into that. But yeah, so these scripts, right? These scripts just, you know, you run it and it's like, okay, I want to set up, say, Nextcloud, or I want to set up, you know, whatever it is, like, because, you know, all kinds of different things run on there, right?
Yep.
Just run the script and it like pulls down the image and builds it and runs it for you, right? So great, except for what the fuck is in these scripts. And like, if you look at any of the forums about Proxmox, like basically people always say don't run the community scripts. Like you get people saying, you know, of course you're not supposed to run the community scripts. We're supposed to say don't run the community scripts, but for what you're trying to do, there is a script that does it, right? You know, but don't run it. Like, you know, of course everyone does, right? And the thing is you can go onto this repo and you can, the fire department's here again.
Can't hear.
Yeah.
But the thing that's flagging for me is when you mentioned the LXC containers being able to share resources.
Yeah.
Does that also mean that they can, I guess, break out of their own container environment?
Yes.
Is that where you're going?
No, that's a design choice. Like you need to run an isolated contained workload. You don't run it in an LXC container, but that's not the issue, right? The issue is that it's these scripts, and yes, they're open source. So you go and you have a look and you're like, okay, well, in fact, sorry. So there's actually a website. So the website is the community scripts. I think it's just communityscripts.org. I'll get the link, but you go on and it's like a catalog of all these different Proxmox runtimes and workloads that you can run, right?
Yep.
And it's just like, okay, click here and paste this and you run it. And it's like, well, fuck's sake. Okay. So you're like, okay, well, what is it? And it's like, basically it's a script that is like run and download this script. So you look at it and it's like, okay. And then you go to the actual repo and it's like, here's the script. And it's like, well, this all looks legit, right? But you're not looking at pure bash. You're looking at a bunch of modules, because the whole community scripts thing is based on this shared module that has like all of this, the Proxmox logic in it that you can build on to do your community script that you're sharing. And then you look at that, and then there's dependencies within dependencies. There's no way you can read it all. And then some of them pull in things. In fact, most of them pull in things from other places. Like none of these things are just running what's in their own repo. Like any of the workloads that I just described, it's got to pull in a binary or an install script from somewhere else to set those up, right? So the read the script fallacy is a complete fallacy, because you can't. Like, it's not real advice. It's bullshit advice. Just like read the EULA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So there are ways around it, right? And there are ways, like, for example, and there are like, if you have like paid packages, right? For example, like if you use Kendo UI or like the Telerik stuff, you have to use their binaries that they give you, and you have to put them in a location where, and you set up a special NuGet feed, and that's how they get installed.
Mm.
Those are like vended, right? So you could have vended. It's so funny. And like what I said earlier about my prognosis being wrong, this is going to be a real full circle thing. But like, you know, like if you, for example, if you create a new Blazor project from the template, that's got Bootstrap like built in.
Yeah.
Like that's not downloading, installing. That's vended, right? Now you could hash that, right? And you could pin it based on hash. So you could establish a trust boundary there. But that's a trust boundary, not a trust chain. And the thing is, the reason we stopped doing that was because we didn't want our payloads to be so huge that we were shipping all that all the time. This is why like your node modules folder gets built on your machine. It doesn't get checked in and distributed.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's that's a trust chain. That's a very different thing to a trust boundary. And it, what I'm saying is that the problem that we've just described as being a huge problem is now it's exponential. This is retreading old ground, right? This is what we spoke about when we spoke about NPN. And this is the supply chain problem all over again, right? It's the same thing. But the problem is, you know, well, it's not, it's the same problem. You know, now we're talking about binaries as well, right? So that means that if you're fetching binaries, what you want to do is not say, I trust this publisher, or I trust this author, or I trust this source. You should be saying, I trust this specific payload. And that's where we should be pinning things based on hashes.
Like a signed binary.
Doesn't even have to be. Like, signing makes it better and worse. But yeah, the signing means that it hasn't been tampered with, right? So sure, if I download a NuGet package that's published by your account and it's signed, like, yes, I know it was published by your account, but that doesn't tell me anything about whether your account's compromised, and it doesn't tell me anything about what's inside the package. So that is good, but it's not the same thing. Thinking? Shall I keep going?
No. I'm just thinking that, like, the hash binary that you're speaking of.
Not just binary. Hash payload.
The hash payload.
Yeah.
So if I'm, just to make sure I'm on the right page here, basically you're just saying, well, that tying what I expect to be coming down to what actually comes down.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I want the version that I've asked for, as opposed to signing that says, well, it was never manipulated on the way.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that still does not completely solve the problem, though.
No, not at all. Not only does it not completely solve the problem, it solves a different problem, or one part of the problem. It's not the absolutely not the whole problem.
Yeah.
The whole problem is sprawl. It does nothing for that. And this is I'll come back to that, though, because I do have something to say about that, but only for NPM and JavaScript. Like, the rest of the world still has this problem. Like NuGet, for example. Like, we're .NET folks, right? We say that .NET doesn't have this problem, right? NuGet doesn't have this problem, but it could. Mm. And the reason that it doesn't is, like this is the thing, is there are some structural systemic reasons why NuGet is less susceptible to this, but it's not immune to it.
Yeah.
Now, like, one of the things that we said was just sheer, like, prevalence of the, like, the same reason there's more viruses on Windows, right? It's just
because there are more machines,
and the target is bigger, so there are people that make more viruses for them. Like, it's a bigger target, and the same is true of NPM. Like, the NPM is, like, much, much bigger than NuGet, right? And you know, like, JavaScript is much bigger than .NET. There are millions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are many, many times more. But the thing is, NuGet is a bit better resistant to this for a couple of reasons. One is that it's binaries, right? And two. But as I said, that's kind of got pros and cons. Although, you know, NuGet does actually audit the binaries. You can go on NuGet, and they're now actually linked to NuGet Package Explorer, and you can poke through them. But there are some limits to that, which is that effectively it DISMs, like, the IL. So you get, like, the API service, but you don't necessarily get visibility into what's going on in private methods. But anyway, that aside, right, the thing that is meaningfully making it less susceptible is friction, release friction. And NPM is getting there, like, it's adding more friction, but it's still pretty low friction to publish a package. Like, NuGet is a bit higher friction.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is the thing, right, there is no reason why someone, like, and I'm not saying this because I'm suggesting that he would do it. It's because it's a name that comes out of my hat, someone that has broadly distributed packages, right? But Jimmy Bogard, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why he couldn't tomorrow release a version of one of his popular packages that, in the constructor for one of the classes, a static class somewhere in there, goes and steals all your user secrets.
Exactly. So that's where I was going to go before, and it doesn't have to be him.
No, absolutely not. As I said, an example.
But not just him. I mean, it could very well just be that his account gets compromised. Someone updates his package under his name and republishes it, which is why I was saying, like, even if it's signed and even if you've got that hash to say this is the version, people will effectively, or there is a potential that people will effectively just say, well, I want that version.
So the thing is, like, the way that we do dependencies in NuGet is that we do specify versions. That's one of the major differences. Like, versions are pinned.
Yep.
And it's impossible. I don't want to say impossible, but someone could release a compromised newer version. That's not going to automatically infect everyone that's got their package dependency as this version or newer, right? Because we tend to pin specific versions.
Yeah.
But looking on, like, NuGet, if I were to look at packages by top numbers of installs, right? So the biggest one by a big margin is, of course, Newtonsoft.json, right? If that got compromised, we'd be in a better position now than we were because people were moving to system.txt.json, which is number four on the list. But basically, like, if you include Newtonsoft as a Microsoft curated package, which it basically is now, if we scan down the list to get to non-Microsoft, so we've got Newtonsoft.json, Microsoft.extensions.dependencyinjection, Microsoft.extensions.logging, then system.txt.json, then Microsoft.bcl.async interfaces, then Azure.core, then Serilog. So we get to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 before it's not basically a first party package. So Serilog could release a package. They could, even maliciously or via compromise, they could release a version that does that, that could, does all sorts of things. And the thing is like locating news. Okay, so next one on the list that isn't Microsoft one is AWS SDK.core. Then at the bottom of this list on page one is Castle.core.
Castle. But yeah, that's the DI container, isn't it? Castle Windsor? Is that what it was?
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, so someone could release a compromised package, right? And this could steal your user secrets. But also, like, if you think about it, that's not just a debug or dev time concern. That's like, that could run in prod. Because in prod, your runtime, your application runtime is considered trusted. So it has access to secrets. And like, even though nowadays we're not really, I mean, we have Key Vault and we do have some things. I mean, if you're running everything in Azure, you generally don't have secrets. You use managed identities to access things. But your malicious code can still access those things, even if it doesn't exfil a secret. But if you're accessing anything outside of Azure, you need some kind of secret. And your runtime is considered trusted and has access to that secret.
Yep.
And you can exfil that. You can put code in a NuGet package. So the reason that it doesn't happen is really it's cultural more than structural. It could happen. Like, nothing that I've just described is impossible in NuGet or .NET. Absolutely can happen.
And that's why we've seen it make the jump from NPM, from Node, JavaScript, into the world of Go.
Yeah.
And it's not just contained there.
Exactly. And this goes back to what you said earlier and what I said I would build on about static analysis, right?
Yeah.
Which is, static analysis can only go so far. Because behaviors like that, static analysis isn't necessarily going to pick it up. Especially, I mean, look, it can. There are certain things it can flag. Like, if you've got something that's pulling in binaries at runtime or downloading things, it can pick that up in the code. But like, static analysis, binaries are opaque to it. Like, if you've got NuGet packages or binary dependencies in your code, the static analysis, it can flag things that it doesn't know and doesn't trust. It can flag things that it knows are compromised.
Yep.
But what it can't do is look inside them and tell you that they're malicious.
No.
Let me give you an example that really illustrates that. Because this one has been nagging at me for a few weeks. This one really bothered me, right? Have you heard of something called RTK?
Don't think so.
Okay. It's very clever. It's Rust token killer. And it's based on a very sensible and sane observation, right? And that's this, right? Like, obviously, you know, from the first of last month, now we're all paying per token on Copilot, right? And like, everything's tokens. Do we know what a token is? No, it's not a word, but it's kind of a word, but whatever. Off topic, right? But now, of course, everyone is very much, whoa, okay, sorry. Talking about supply chain attack, Rust token killer. Very clever, right? So it says it can reduce your token usage by, I don't know, like 89%, 3 times longer sessions, 30 plus commands. It's nearly 70,000 stars on GitHub. And it's very, very clever. What it does is it takes this idea that, like, when an agentic harness, a model is running things on your machine, like a build or a grep or a test.
Yep.
There's a fuck of a lot of noise in there that you don't need. Like, like the logs and like just the sheer amount of things that go into what an agent or a model sees as part of its context. A lot of it is dead. It's just things that you don't need. So this is very clever. What it is, it's basically a terminal hook, right? It's a terminal process hook plugin, right? And what it does is it intercepts anything going into or out of your terminal and strips away things that are, you know, noise, right? So there's an example here. There's a bunch of examples. Cargo, Python, Go, git diff, git hit, status, git log, read, grep, find, ls. I won't bother with the cargo one. I'll try and find one that you would know. So let's look at, so git status, right? So if you type git status, the output is like on branch master, your branch is up to date with origin/master, changes not staged for commit, use git add file, blah, 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 use git restore, blah, 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 list of the files, modified, untracked, no changes added to commit. What it ends up saying is sending is, if you do RTK git status master dot 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 origin/master -3, which is the three files that modified, then *2, and then the two files that are untracked, and that's it. That's 30 tokens versus 120 tokens, which is a 75% saving.
Yep.
Git log 1430 tokens down to 194. Grep is probably the big one, right? One of the big ones. Oh, actually, that's not as big. Read like is 95%. Find ls steps. It's big savings, and it's very sensible. It's very clever, and it works. But here's the problem. In fact, looking at the website now, which I will send you the link to, and we'll put it in the show notes. How do you install it? Here, run this script, which literally it goes to raw.github.com, downloads the script, and runs it. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, but here's the problem. It's like, okay, like that sounds great, but think about what it's doing. It's hooking into your terminal. It's intercepting every input and output in your terminal. So anytime you do sudo and like type in your password, every key you paste in, everything that you query from anywhere, like any input or output to your terminal, it's intercepting it and manipulating it and potentially sending it God knows where, right?
Yes, so, but
right,
okay. It is a CLI. I'm looking at the GitHub repo right now, right? It's a CLI. So their examples here all start with RTK.
But that's now.
Right. They do show that you can alias it, right? And you can, so yeah, like it's the Git examples here are RTK Git status. So it's not intercepting that Git status.
So I did notice that. That is actually a change, and it's a sensible one. That's not how it was.
Yeah.
Like at first it was, I'm talking from historical context here, so I need to make sure I can prove it. So I'm going to look through the repo. Look, I'm going to validate this, right? Because I was just looking at it and looking at the same thing that you were looking at, and I was thinking that looks different, because I'm pretty sure, and I'll confirm it, because if I'm wrong, it's still a problem here, right? But the way that I thought it worked, which is that it just installs itself, sits there in the background and intercepts everything,
that's just really bad,
right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a keylogger.
Absolutely, right?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's how it was, but I will look that up and I will verify it and I will confirm it, right? If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But here's the thing, it's like, okay, let's say you're not doing that, right? Let's say you're running their RTK CLI every time. That's a much, much better situation, but it is still something that you are running everything through. So you're doing RTK and then you're doing all the things that I said, right? Which is giving it keys, giving it tokens, giving it unrestricted access to everything on your machine, everything, right?
Yep.
So then I did what you just did, which is go to the repo. So I'm like, okay, well, there's a lot here. Like, fucking hell. All right. Well, let's have a look. Like, the first thing that I want to do is have a look at install.sh. What's it doing? It's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Blah. That seems reasonable. I'm looking at it. What's it doing? Yeah. Oh, okay. Right. Okay. So now I look at it and it's like, okay, so basically it's pulling data here. It's pulling scripts and binaries from a repo. And the thing that worries me right away is I look at it and I say, well, those are variables. Like it's got, you know, github.com/$curlybrace repo.
Yep.
Okay. So I've got to trace that back. So I go right up to the top and I find where all these things are defined. And I'm like, okay, it's all defined here. It's this repo. Right. Thankfully, it's pulling binaries like a tar.gz from this repo. Like, where is that? Okay. Well, it's under releases. Like, okay. Well, all right. Now I've got to go into the GitHub folder and I've got to look at the workflows and I have to look at how they're publishing it. And I have to say, all right, if I look at their release, can I be confident that that binary, because like if you go onto the code page, right, you can see they've got releases enabled. I can go in there and I can see the release and I can see the assets and I can see, okay, oh, there's even a checksum, right? Is that what it's pulling down? Is that what the script's going to pull down? It's like, okay, well, to figure that out, I've got to go into the workflow and I've got to look. This is before I've even looked at the code in the repo to see what the code in the repo is doing. So, okay, I've got to look at the workflow. Like, what's the workflow doing? Okay, well, let's look at release, right? So I look at release and I'm like, okay, this looks pretty reasonable. Is there a way here that I can verify that the releases and the checksums that I'm pulling down in this script have been built by this script here and it's not just for show? Can I verify that? Yes, I can. But that's not something anyone does. It's not something I do. That's too hard. Nobody's going to do that. But it gets worse, right? It's like, even if I can, what is this build doing? Look at all of these things that are in here. Look at all these actions it's pulling in. Like, am I going to audit every single one of these? Some of these are like legit. They're things that it needs and makes sense. But like, am I going to like, wow, like, oh, hang on, I'm looking for a user. Uses actions checkout. Okay, fine. Uses DTOLNAY/rust toolchain. Okay. Uses actions upload artifact. Fine. That one makes sense, right? But it, like, this is just this one. You go through all of them. There's other ones. They're pulling in actions. Then I've got to go to, like, I've got to track down that action, right? And I've got to see, what is that doing? How is that building out? Is that injecting anything malicious? Is the version that's the binary that's referenced the one that's used here? Can I trust it? By the time you get to the end of the chain, is the chain still the same chain if you go back to the beginning? The point is, it's impossible.
And this goes back to what you were saying before, right?
Yeah.
What was the term you used? The read the install script fallacy?
Read the script fallacy, yeah.
Read the script fallacy, right?
Exactly.
Right? No, you can't.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's it. It's like, yeah, like this thing with RTK, and like, yes, it very much materially changes things in a major way if it is something that you run rather than something that just hooks into your terminal. Yeah. And I may be wrong about that, but if I'm not wrong, that's really worrying. And like, clearly everyone else agreed because they changed it, but I'll check. But like, even if not, it's still something that everyone's running without really doing any, you know, looking into this to the level that we'd want. And well, the thing that really worries me is the number of people that I've spoken to, and I've gone through this same thing that I've just explained to you, right? And people that have said, like, oh, are you using RTK? And I'm like, oh, no, why? Like, when I explain it, and I go through it, and I usually get the reaction that's like, yeah, well, that's terrifying. Anyway, back to saving 97% of my token budget.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are tech people.
Exactly. And I mean, just to say, I'm looking at it now, the very first commit on the readme file does have the RTK prefix for the commands. So just to jump in there, but I mean, that doesn't negate anything you've said.
Well, one thing, but
one thing, but not, I mean, the spirit of what you're saying is still extremely valid.
It's still true of any time you run RTK, right?
Yeah.
It's not true of installing something blindly into your whole terminal. But it's still, anytime you run RTK, you're trusting something that, can you trust it? Like, what's the chain of trust?
Absolutely. And it's, I mean, but is that not the whole open source ecosystem that you've just described there? Install this dependency because
It's the reality of it, not the spirit of it, but it's the reality of it. Yes.
And that's just it. It's the idea that everyone sort of says, well, it's open source, which therefore means there's going to be a million and one different eyes on it, and someone else is going to have found the issues with it. So therefore, it must be safe for me to use.
Yeah. On the one hand, it's an abdication of responsibility. But on the other hand, it's really, at an individual level, it's rational. It's a completely irrational situation. It's a rational thing for a person to assume what you just said, right? It's rational for an all person, because like, everything that I just went through, and that's scratching the surface, right?
Yeah.
I don't do that every time because I would go fucking insane. And like, even with RTK, like, I don't use RTK, right?
Yeah.
And that's because I just could not rationalize that to myself. I couldn't reconcile it. And I have the tab open, and I keep the tab open because I would like to use it. And this ties back into something earlier, but I just want to finish off. But you know, that's not true of everything. Like, there are other things that I use that maybe are no different. Things that I certainly haven't gone down that deep rabbit hole of dependency chains. And you know, like, on the open source thing, like, has anyone ever read every single line in the Linux kernel? You know, I don't know, but probably not. But I mean, look, the Geotan thing is the canonical example, right? But the spirit of open source is, or was, that the code is there for you to look at and modify and do what you want with, right?
Yeah.
So the assumption was that we were talking about small enough units of code distributed among small enough groups of people that reading it was not impossible.
Yeah.
That's what the principle is based on. And that's not the reality. And that's how, like, that's how this happened. That's literally how Miasma is the Shia zoonotic spillover to go. That's how this has happened. So back to where I said this would come back to earlier was about the static analysis and the shortcomings of static analysis and the trust thing, and why this ties into what I was saying about version pinning with hashes, right?
Mm.
What you really want is something more than static analysis. You want dynamic analysis. Maybe that's something we can do with AI. I don't know. But if you can literally sandbox and detonate a payload.
I mean, dynamic analysis analysis exists, but you're still not going to have the same, it's not going to have the same effect for the same reasons that you mentioned earlier, in that you don't have visibility over the inner workings of the packages that you're downloading.
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying don't look at what it is, look at what it does. So if you can put it in a sandbox and detonate it, and if you can monitor it in a completely safe, controlled environment, and you can see what it does, you know, where it phones home or not, what files it touches, you know, so on and so forth. And if you can do that rigorously enough to the point where you trust it and you trust that version, you can hash and pin the hash of that version. And that is not the solution, but that's the only way I think you can really have honest confidence.
So would that imply, and the way, if I take that to the next extreme, is a package management platform like NuGet or NPM, if they could actually offer that as a service and only allow published versions or published packages that pass that self-detonation sandbox test that you're talking about?
I mean, first of all, it's very hard. It's like I'm throwing it out there like it's something that you could easily do. It's very hard. So I don't want to trivialize it. It's not like the fact that we don't have that is not a criticism. It's not like that's something trivial that we should all be doing. And that's the first thing. Second of all, I mean, yes, but you're still moving the goalposts then. And I don't want to go like Tim Foyler here and go all TNO security. And like we have spoken about this before in a sense, like when we spoke about the Euro Office thing, but you've got, like when we spoke earlier about trust chains and trust boundaries, you've got to think about where your boundaries are and where your chain ends. And the question is, if we get to the point where we're saying the only way you can trust things is if they're being detonated in a sandbox and kind of validated. And also, by the way, when you do that, you're still not saying that something's safe. You're saying that it didn't trigger any of the flags that you were looking for. Right? So even then, it's not perfect. But like, if we're getting to the point where we're saying that's necessary, are we then by default saying that you have to do that yourself? You can't trust someone else to do that. And then...
unless that's their business model.
Well, even then, right? But the point is that once you go down that path, you're going down the path of, well, I've got to draw the line somewhere. Like, who do I trust? Do I trust that Microsoft's accounts are not compromised and the packages that are signed and released from Microsoft are trustworthy?
And I mean, that's what I mean by if that's your business model, right? If you live and die by the fact that your reputation is based on you being the most secure package management platform out there.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, you're opening yourself up as a target, but if that is your business model, then that's what you're, that's where you're spending all your money, right? Like, to use your argument, like, what's to say we should trust Microsoft Defender or any other antivirus software out there, right?
Funny enough, there was actually a, I completely forgot to mention this. There was a vulnerability found in Microsoft Defender.
Bad example then. Fine. But my point there is...
No, you're right. But that, I understand your point. And my point is that, going back to what I said before, is I feel like that's a rational response. Like, the way that we collectively treat this stuff is to say, well, is it reasonable? And is it reasonable to say, I'm gonna trust this because the trust signals are strong enough, versus we should all be finger wagging ourselves for trusting these things without doing this level of diligence and without having that level of diligence published. I mean, I think that's what I mean by it being rational. Is like, once you start going down that path, it literally becomes a never ending chain for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're here to do. Don't get me wrong. Like, there's absolutely an element of diligence, and there clearly are things that you shouldn't trust, you know, and it is important to learn. I don't want to say where the line is, because that's the thing, is there isn't a line. There's a fuzzy spectrum, and the rules aren't concrete either. It's just like, this is just the reality of the world we live in, is that you've got to be continually on your guard and shifting and adapting, and it's a fucking pain in the ass. But yeah, with all that said, I did say earlier that I'd tell you why I thought I was wrong. And all of this relates back to everything we just said, kind of comes together in one place on this, right? Which is around NPM.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't wrong about NPM. NPM is a rabid dog and it needs to be put down. Yep. Like, I'm not budging on that. I'm sorry. Like, I don't see anything that, and if I see something that contradicts the things that give me that opinion, I'll change that opinion, but I haven't seen anything. What I said was that it was inseparable from JavaScript and from the culture and from the language. And that's where I've changed my mind a little bit. And I said that my analysis was correct and my diagnosis was correct, but my prognosis was wrong. And my prognosis was that basically there's no hope. JavaScript has to go. It has to be replaced by something else, because that's the only way of getting rid of all the problems.
Yep.
And the thing that has changed my mind on that is I'm not saying that JavaScript will be saved, or even that it can, but there is a way that it could, right? And that is with the new HTML APIs, and not in their entirety, but what they're telling us. So there's some new, like, if you think about, like, let's talk specifically about what the problem is with JavaScript and what my problem is with JavaScript. I don't hate JavaScript, okay? I don't like it. It's inelegant. It's ugly. It has nothing that encourages good practices. I tell you a whole list of things I dislike about it, right? But yeah. I don't hate it. They're just things. They are what it is. What I hate about it is that, you know, like, JavaScript isn't a problem. I mean, you know, it's not like we're just using it. Like, everything that I just described, all those problems, they don't really matter when you're fetching or posting APIs and manipulating the DOM.
Stuff that should be pretty stock standard in HTML.
Well, you can't manipulate the DOM in HTML.
No.
And that's, why not?
No, but yeah, I mean, like, as a brainstorming kind of exercise, like, why not?
Well, I guess
why can't the APIs allow us to do that?
I guess that's what the IETF are asking, and that's kind of where I'm going with this, right? And, like, if you think about like JavaScript, right? Like, manipulating the DOM, doing some API stuff, or AJAX as it was called, and now we're talking about fetch and, you know, whatever else, and all the other REST APIs and everything else. But even that's not the problem, right? The problem is the frameworks, and the problem is treating it as infrastructure. And, like, the things that I just said that I don't like about it, like not being statically typed, it's not safe, right? You know, not encouraging good practices. These are all things that scream at you right in the face. Do not use me for infrastructure. Do not use me for critical, important things, right? And that's the problem. And it's like, if you look at, like, yeah, my problem is using JavaScript for infrastructure. That is the problem. But even aside from that, like, if you look at everything that we do with it, like, okay, we had jQuery. And from there, we've had, like, everything that we've got now, from jQuery to Spars to, like, you know, if you look at, like, React, Vue, Next, Nuxt, Angular, all these other things, like, all these frameworks and all of this, like, piles and piles and piles and mountains of code that gets shipped because the web is not an application framework. It's not. It's the web. And we've spent 20, 30 years treating it as an application framework. And that means we've contorted JavaScript into a monstrosity it wasn't supposed to be. And that's where the problem comes from. Now, to your point and to what's changing about the browser, and I mean, if you think about, like, one of the things is that you couldn't have, like, media queries, right? You didn't have media queries. So you needed to use JavaScript to learn things about the user's environment, about their user agent string, about their screen resolution. And you would make decisions based on that. You don't have to do that now because CSS does it.
Sure.
Right? Like, even back in the day, it was like, well, are they on Firefox or are they on Internet Explorer? Yeah. I better, like, yeah, figure that out, right? Well, now you don't need that because CSS does it. Things like showing a modal dialogue, CSS can do that now. Mm-hmm. Things like, more importantly, the things that are coming now in the browser and new things, like, literally there's like accordion, the accordion, right? We have that now. The new button APIs that you're getting, I don't know if you've seen, we should do a whole episode on this, actually. We really should. We should do a whole episode on, you know, modern HTML, where HTML is going. But, like, it's something simple, like even just something small like Alpine.js, for, although that's getting away from it a bit. But the way that the browser platform itself is going now, you can do all of this pretty much in HTML, in the native HTML and CSS APIs, right? You don't need, even things like, you want to fake some client-side navigation, but, well, although client-side navigation is actually easy anyway, like, you don't need a framework for that.
Yeah.
Things like modals, buttons, not API calls, that's separate, but, like, all of the things that we use frameworks for, all the things that we use Angular for, like, basically real-time changes to the DOM and changes to styles, animations, visual transitions, all this sort of stuff, you can do now in HTML and CSS, and the things that are coming, you'll be able to do even more. And where I'm going with this is that...
The one thing that I think you haven't jumped on there, and I'm just curious to see... because it's been a while since I've had a look at that space. But what about state management?
I will get to that.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, no, I'll address that now. That was going to be my mic drop, right?
Because to me, like, if I'm looking at a web app, yes, it's routing, it's forms, DOM manipulation, but it's also state management.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's funny you should say that, because we spent 10 years doing Spars, right? And saying that state should live in the browser. And now we're spending the next 10 years, it's like been 7 or so now. But we're now in the phase where we're saying, no, we should just state is on the server. And, like, we're talking now about, I mean, yes, like, there's still a bit of a hype around multi-rendering or, you know, so what's it called in Blazor?
Hybrid. Like the hybrid apps?
No, so the render modes. So you can have, so Next.js does it as well. So you've got server-side rendering, server-side pre-rendering, and you can have server-side interactivity and client-side interactivity.
Yep.
But basically, if you look at Blazor Server and you look at what pretty much everyone is saying now is like the trend is towards, we were probably wrong to do that. Let's just do state on the server. That's more secure. It's easier. It's more secure from the whole fucking architecture that we've just, the mess of the architecture we've just described. But it's also more secure, right? The debate between cookies and tokens, right? Cookies are more secure than tokens. That's not a statement I make lightly. Sometimes I do have to explain it and sometimes I do have to defend it, but I do defend it and I do believe it's true.
We covered this in our auth episode, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, like you don't need tokens. You don't need to worry about local storage. I mean, look, there is an encryption API in the browser, but it's still vulnerable to a whole bunch of different things. Like the server is more secure. State is better on this. Like we're now saying basically we were wrong. And with the new browser APIs as well, you can have rich client interactivity with state on the server, have it secure, have it responsive, have it be fast, small payloads, it renders quickly. The server side stuff is pre-rendered. This is the thing. This is where we're going now. We're going back that way. And this is not just me saying that. That's the trend. Like, look at the modern web dev trend. Even in the .NET space, you know, there are still plenty of people building full stack apps and building their UI, their front end in React or Angular or Vue or whatever else. But there are a lot of people saying, yeah, you know what? We're just going back to Razor Pages and maybe using a bit of Alpine.js or HTMX or whatever to do some, you know, real-time updates, that kind of stuff. I don't like HTMX because it's basically PHP where you're literally building the UI on the back end and sending it to the browser, but that's a whole other thing. But something small like Alpine.js is awesome. But then even that, like, and I have to say, I think a lot of what we're seeing now out of the new HTML spec is definitely inspired by that. It's like things, as I said, all the things like transitions, interactivity, you know, some animation stuff, modals, like it's becoming basically now trivial to build your solution so that your state is on the back end, your security is on the back end, the API surface, the code surface on the front end is minimal. And if that's where we go, right, and we go back to JavaScript literally just making API calls and manipulating the DOM, we literally solve every single one of the problems that I just described, right? You don't need those.
Except for those people who have built their servers using Node.
Yes. Yes, that is true. I don't really know what to say about that.
Choose a more secure runtime environment.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's, on the one hand, you can say, right tool for the job, why use JavaScript for building your API? They can respond and say, why use C# for building your UI? And they could talk about Blazor. I don't know. But yeah, look, you're right. Like, so apart from that group, yes. But in terms of like JavaScript in the browser, right?
Yeah.
If we go back to JavaScript basically manipulating the DOM and making API calls, then it goes back to the thing that it was meant for, the thing it's really fucking good at. It becomes unburdened of all the things that make it dangerous. It's no longer contorted into a monster it doesn't want to be. You eliminate the need for NPM completely, right? You don't need it because you don't need to distribute those packages. You can have the scripts that you write are small and you can write them yourself and know exactly what's in them. If you want to distribute, like if there are things that are distributed because they're helpful, we can go back to what we used to do, which is have them on a CDN, and like that's problematic. But again, like you can literally look at it and read it. It's going to be small enough that you can read it and understand it. And then once you have, and it's you comfortable, it's safe, you can pin to that version, which you can validate with a hash. Like nearly every single one of the problems that we mentioned goes away if we accept that the browser does what the browser does, and that, you know, the browser gives us everything we need. We don't start trying to use JavaScript to make the web an application framework. We let the web become an application framework, which is what's happening. And we just use JavaScript as a scripting language to manipulate the DOM. No more what the fuck is in this binary. And look, like I said, you know, other ecosystems are not immune to this. They still have problems. But like the biggest one, the biggest supply chain issue, the biggest thing plaguing the world at the moment from a security perspective is NPM. Mm-hmm. And this is the way that it could go away. Now, as I said, like the reason that I don't say will and don't say can and I say could is because that's what I see as one thing that can happen. That doesn't mean that it will, because the reality is it's not just all those people that have built their servers on Node. What about all those people that have built their businesses on NPM packages and that whole ecosystem? And there are a lot of them. I mean, even the example I gave earlier, like Tailwind, how would that work? And also, we're all wrong about Tailwind. That's a whole other rant and a whole other episode, but we are all wrong about Tailwind.
I never really bought into Tailwind.
Okay.
I don't know. It didn't quite sell me on that one.
Fair enough. I would say your faculties are intact.
But I mean, we can, like you said, that's a different discussion.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's where we're at. I mean, I think there's two things here. I think we've pulled apart. We've revisited that same rant. We've pulled it apart. I've talked about how I think there is the potential for a way out. I don't know. Like I'm not saying that I've changed my opinion, that I'm saying that I was wrong to say that there's no way out, because there is. Whether it gets taken remains to be seen. But in the meantime, and the thing that sparked this whole thing, in the meantime, we have this rabid dog running rampant through the development world with these things that are mutating and infecting other species. Zoonotic spillover. It's happening. And that's why I said it's not an analogy anymore. It's a pattern. Like the fact that we saw it in Maven and now we've seen it in Go. Could this happen in NuGet? Yeah. Like we literally described the vector earlier.
Yeah. And you flagged this last time.
Yeah.
You flagged the NuGet vector last time.
Yeah, could happen. Absolutely could.
So I think actually, like, the simple solution is just stop using open source and write everything yourself from scratch.
Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah. All right. Just don't use any other packages. Yeah. Or just get yourself another drink and call it a night.
Say bollocks to it and enjoy the sunshine while it lasts.
That's right.
You remember that one?
No, I'll just pretend I did.
Okay. That was an ad for Foster's Ice. It starts off as this serious thing about global warming.
In Australia, we didn't get Foster's ads.
Fair enough. Don't eat it. It just comes out of the fucking taps, mate.
If you're in the UK.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen it on tap here in Australia, ever.
I meant like literally the sink taps.
But yeah. Oh, those taps.
Yeah. I looked into it once and Foster's is actually brewed in Scotland.
Surprise.
Or at least certainly the Foster's they get in the UK. I don't know. But no, you don't have a drink tonight.
I woke up this morning not feeling 100%. So I thought tonight I shall abstain and hopefully knock this over before it floors me.
Okay. Well, I felt like I needed one and deserved one today. So
yeah, it sounds like you had an awesome day.
Yeah. Rock and roll.
Look, at least you know that when you go to sleep tonight, and you wake up in the morning, that it pretty much can't get any worse than that.
Yeah. No.
Touch wood for that one.
I mean, I just don't want to tempt fate, that's all.
Yeah.
I mean, look, like, good news all round, to be honest. I mean, not good news for Go, but I think on this meth head situation, like, it could have been a lot worse. Like,
absolutely.
There was no one in the car, first of all.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big win.
There was no one crossing the road.
No one crossing the road. Yeah. Like, on this security situation, like, I'm certainly much more optimistic than I was. Like, I think that's a real way forward, and that's certainly a way that I didn't see before. And like I said, that doesn't solve every problem, but that's the biggest problem, and there's a potential solution, so that's good.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the exact line. As the unknown future rolls towards us, I face it for the first time with hope, because if a machine, a Terminator, can learn the value of human life, maybe we can too. Don't know that one?
You've left me speechless on that one. Is that Terminator 1 or 2?
2.
I'm just more speechless that you can rattle that off the top of your head.
I don't know if I got it right, but it's one of my, the unknown future rolls towards us. I face it for the first time with a sense of hope, because if a machine, a Terminator, can learn the value of human life, maybe we can too. One of my favorite lines from a movie. You should watch it.
I've seen that.
Well, you should watch it again.
It's been so long since I've seen it.
Yeah, same. My sister is obsessed with it, so I often get messages with Terminator 2 quotes. So
fair enough.
She was a massive, massive Arnie fan back in the day.
Yeah. One day I'll get the kids to watch it when they're old enough.
Yeah.
See, my problem with that was I think I saw Terminator 2 before I saw Terminator 1.
I'm pretty sure I definitely did, yeah.
And it just confused the hell out of me, because I'm like, why is this kid running away from someone who's trying to save him?
Actually, no. I definitely didn't see Terminator 2 first.
Okay.
And there's a reason I remember that, because of something that happened in the film, and I was like, oh, well, it's only halfway through, and like, this must be near the end. Oh. Kid logic. It doesn't even matter. But yeah, no, I definitely saw the first one first.
I'm just seeing the time.
Watch it again, just not tonight, because it's late, and you need your beauty sleep. But I do think that is it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
And I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Yeah, you need a shave as well.
Yep.
That is the most hair I've seen on your head since I've known you.
Yep. I know. I've had to get longer than this.
Not since I've known you, I don't think.
Not that you paid attention.
No, true. I will try and pay. I'll try and be more attentive more to your changing hair
my facial hair.
I wasn't talking about the facial hair.
On the top there, yeah, I know.
It's, yeah.
It needs, needs
sides,
a trim.
I don't know if there's much on the top.
No. Sorry, is the glare just getting to you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.